Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the continuing humanitarian disaster in northern Iraq as besieged religious minorities remain under threat from the Islamic State fighters, while back in the capital, the government in Baghdad remains paralyzed in a leadership struggle. Bilal Saab, an expert on Middle East security and politics, who is a senior fellow for Middle East security at the Atlantic Council's Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security, joins us to discuss the nature and intentions of the Islamic State, who have formed a modern, well-equipped terrorist army that is highly mobile and so far has not suffered any major defeats. Then we'll examine the religious credentials of the new self-proclaimed caliph and head of the Islamic State, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, with William McCants, a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy and director of the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution. We will look into al-Baghdadi's background and assess what plans beyond taking territory IS has as it paints the government buildings it has captured black, seeming to offer a dark vision for the future for those who fall captive under its banner of convert or die. Then finally, we will speak with Peter Van Buren, a State Department veteran who led two State Department provincial reconstruction teams, which he wrote about in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. We will discuss the historical amnesia and political spin underway to pin the Iraq disaster on President Obama, who seems determined to extricate the U.S. from the Bush-Cheney mess in Mesopotamia, in spite of the deepening implosion of the former country that remains a victim of drive-by liberation by the United States. And joining us now is Bilal Saab, who is an expert on Middle East security and politics with a particular focus on the Levant and the Gulf. Currently, he's a senior fellow for Middle East security at the Atlantic Council's Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bilal Saab.
Thanks a lot, Ian. It's good to be back with you. I appreciate you hosting me.
Well, thank you. And of course, the news from Iraq is so grim. You've got thousands of people stuck on a mountainside, many bodies strewn around, helicopters coming in. They can only pick up about 20 people at a time, and thousands of people rush the helicopters because it brings back memories of the exit from Saigon. And then you've got back at the capital, you've got this dysfunction where the president has appointed a new prime minister and Nouri al-Maliki refuses to budge. So is there any hope here? Do you see any possibility of the situation being resolved?
My goodness, I don't know where to start. You're absolutely right. It's a mess all over the place, politically speaking, the security front. And the problem is that we really cannot distinguish between the short term and the long term. Now, obviously, the immediate priority is to roll back the advances of this massive terrorist organization, which is more like the jihadist army right now, which is ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Rolling it back would allow for those longer-term challenges, specifically fixing Iraq's politics, to take place. You need a sufficiently secure political space so that the politicians in Baghdad and in other areas in the country can start a long-term process of trying to figure out where they can agree on the most pertinent issues that divide them. But the most important priority right now is to roll back ISIS.
But how can that be done? It certainly can't be done by bombing alone. And a lot of analysts have suggested that by bombing ISIS or IS, you in fact are doing them a favor, because there's nothing better for your jihadist credentials than to be bombed by the United States.
Well, frankly, I don't agree with that assessment. I think that those who have been arguing that there is a military solution to this enormous problem in Iraq obviously are wrong in their assessments. But I think that there's a lot of benefits that U.S. air power can offer, and at this point, specifically trying to hold the line, basically, as far as the Kurdish forces in Erbil, hold the line, help them stand their ground, in order to prevent ISIS from mounting its assault against Erbil, which is very important for U.S. interests. As you know, the United States has military personnel in Erbil, And the entire stability of Kurdistan is at stake here. And this is the one thing that has been working in Iraq. It's been an island of stability. It's worth preserving. And the Peshmerga, which is the Kurdish militia that has been defending Kurdistan, is in, I don't want to say is in dire straits. They have been surprised by the advances of ISIS. And as you know, in military operations, surprise offers huge benefits. It's not that they were weak, but they were just, you know, surprised by the advances. They didn't have sufficient heavy armor and weaponry to confront ISIS. But now, with the support of air power, the surprise is no longer there. They're now mounting a counteroffensive. It's very important that the United States intervene this quickly to support its partners in the Middle East, and specifically the Kurds. Now, it's back to politics. As you mentioned, there's a crisis in Baghdad. There's hopefully a new prime minister, even though the old prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki, is still very much defiant. And I'm not sure, quite frankly, why, Ian, because he's lost a lot of support in Tehran, the primary backer of Nouri al-Maliki. Iraq's Shiite leadership, including Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, is no longer really that enthusiastic about Maliki. As a matter of fact, he sent a letter to Maliki telling him, please do not run for a third term. This is the time for you to step out. And Muqtada Sadr, if you remember him, who's also very influential in Iraqi politics still, is looking forward to the new Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi. Therefore, I'm not sure what Nouri al-Maliki is really hoping to achieve with so few supporters left, even within his own coalition. But we'll see. We'll see how it plays out. The next 24 hours, 48 hours are going to be crucial, in my opinion.
Again, I'm speaking with Bilal Saab, who is an expert on Middle East security and politics with a particular focus on the Levant and the Gulf. Currently, he's a senior fellow for Middle East security at the Atlantic Council's Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security. But ISIS or IS do control this Mosul Dam, which is apparently the biggest generator of electricity and supplier of water for the entire country. My understanding is that dam itself is an accident waiting to happen that has to be continually fortified with grout because it wasn't properly built in the first place. And if it were to split apart, a 65-foot wall of water would go through Mosul, which is 30 miles downstream, and then all the way down through Baghdad to the Gulf. Now that IS forces have this dam, do we have any knowledge of whether they're maintaining it as it needs to be in order just for the structure to hold, let alone use it as a weapon of mass destruction, which, of course, apparently Saddam had planned to use some of the locks as weapons of mass destruction?
Right. I mean, it's hard to really speak with any detail sitting here in Washington about military dynamics and events on the ground right now in Iraq. But you're absolutely right that this is a very tricky issue, and it could pose a major security threat to the entire country. As a matter of fact, a nightmare, which is why I think Washington is going to be very cautious with regard to its air campaign. And the only way to deal with this would have to be through special operations forces and ground troops. Obviously not American, because this president is certainly not committing ground troops to Iraq. But it's either the Kurds, the Iraqi army, and perhaps, you know, clandestine regional forces that would also come to the support of the Iraqi army. Certainly it is so tricky and delicate that I think it will be very hard to use, you know, air power to prevent ISIS from flooding the dam, basically.
And wouldn't it mean that if you accelerate the use of air power against ISIS, how long before they'll start using civilian populations as human shields?
Well, that's certainly a consideration, and it's obviously a risk. But I think what air power would do is that it would prevent ISIS from mounting highly centralized military attacks. What the air power would do is that would cause them to disperse, to mount decentralized attacks, which automatically would lessen the military significance and effectiveness of their attacks. I mean, this is a very brutal and terrorist organization, so I would think that the most extreme measures they would resort to, including using civilians as shields, obviously. But there has to be a very direct and decisive military action to their advance. Otherwise, the alternative we all know of, greater influence and an expansion of the terrorist state, which is a huge risk to all Iraqi factions and the country's neighbors as a whole.
So, Bilal Sab, what explains this sudden emergence of, you described ISIS or IS as a jihadi army or a terrorist army, which it clearly is. The numbers that you hear are only 10,000, but I've never heard of 10,000 soldiers taking so much territory so fast. It strikes me that there's got to be more to the picture than this former inmate at Camp Buka, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Are there other forces behind it? You know, regional forces, perhaps the Saudis?
That's a good question. And I think your suspicion is right that there is much more to it than this terrorist army that has suddenly emerged in Iraq. I think that it all started with Al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2003 after the U.S. invasion of Iraq and occupation. And from AQI was born this ISIS in later years. It has found a home in Syria due to the conflict there and the civil war there, and it has spilled over to Iraq, basically joining forces with a number of Sunni militants. At the end of the day, ISIS is at the forefront of this Sunni insurrection against the Shiite government in Baghdad. ISIS tends to be the most brutal and the loudest, it is the most battle-tested, I guess. But that doesn't mean that they are alone. They are part of a larger coalition of Sunni militants. And a lot of people suspect that one of the reasons, I don't want to say the most important reasons, but perhaps one of the reasons why it has been so effective in its military operation is because it has been aided by former Iraqi generals who used to work for Saddam Hussein. One of them might be Azad Duri, who is... we're not sure if he's still present in Iraq, but he's been referred to as the mastermind or the orchestrator of ISIS operations or more broadly Sunni militancy inside Iraq. So we're not entirely sure to what extent they have received a lot of coordination and intelligence help from former Ba'athist commanders in the army, but they're not alone. They're not alone. And as you may have mentioned, regionally, Saudi Arabia carries a lot of influence within the Sunni tribes. That doesn't mean that they are directly offering support to ISIS, but at the same time, they are not really, they're not really concerned that much about what ISIS is doing inside Iraq because it benefits them. It weakens the country's Shiites in Iraq. It provides them with some sort of foothold inside the country, and it increases their influence, and it gives them some type of leverage, even though it's a very risky and dangerous kind of leverage because there is that risk of blowback, as you know. But it is the one tool that they have used indirectly through the Sunni tribes to increase their influence and to make sure that whatever next Iraqi government that will be created, the Sunnis will be brought back to government. So this weapon of Sunni militancy, as extreme as it is and represented by ISIS and others, is a Saudi tool that is being used to make sure that their interests in Iraq and elsewhere are being protected and preserved.
And the fact that ISIS or IS has literally cut across the so-called Shia Crescent, which links Iran through Iraq to Syria and to Hezbollah in Lebanon, how much have they cut across that? I mean, they seem to be geographically right placed there in between. And I can't imagine, I don't know whether Iran's supply lines to Assad have been cut or in Hezbollah, have they?
I mean, they are operating in the borderlands of Syria, Iraq, very close to Jordan, Lebanon as well. I mean, as you know, today there's an ongoing military struggle today between the Lebanese army and Sunni militants that are suspected to be members of ISIS in the north of the country, and specifically in the town of Arsal. For now, the Lebanese army has been successful in confronting ISIS and rolling it back, but this might only be a tactical success, and I think it's perhaps only a matter of time before the militants return to the north and create havoc there. And I think that their eyes are on Tripoli, which Lebanese call the capital of the north in Lebanon. It has always been very precious for Sunni Islamists throughout the history of Lebanon, and it is obviously very close to Syria. So they're operating. The reason why they're called Islamic State of Syria and Iraq, or Islamic State of Syria and the Levant, is because they just don't recognize borders, and they realize that these are all borders that were created by colonial powers as a result of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. I mean, if you watch a lot of the videos of these militants, they're pretty savvy, actually, in media. They have some pretty interesting skills. But they show that they really have high disregard, obviously, for the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and they're there to change borders, to create a new political map in the Middle East, and pave the way for the emergence of an Islamic State that would rule over the entire Middle East. Obviously, that's their aspiration. Whether or not it happens is an entirely different story.
But Bilal Saab, even though Al-Qaeda have disowned ISIS, it seems that ISIS is different, as much as Al-Qaeda was a pretty xenophobic anti-Western operation. And it looks as though ISIS and the Islamic State are welcoming foreign jihadis. In fact, they're recruiting them. They're supposedly at least 200 American passports holders within ISIS, and there's supposed to be over 1,000 European passport holders within ISIS. Is that your understanding?
I'm not sure about the numbers. I trust you on those numbers, but there's certainly a concern on the part of a lot of European capitals of their own citizens flying to Syria and to Iraq to fight alongside ISIS. There's certainly the concern about blowback, that whenever this thing subsides, they would return to their countries, and they are already radicalized, and they might engage in terrorist activities. But the difference between Al-Qaeda and ISIS is certainly not about the level of brutality or Al-Qaeda thinking that ISIS is just so extreme in its application of its ideology. It certainly is. I think it's just a disagreement over priorities and a disagreement over means that are being used here, and the extent to which ISIS has focused more on prematurely establishing a state, where Al-Qaeda is, I think, a little bit more, strategically speaking, looking to hurt Western interests and attack Western interests. And then down the road in this process, there would be an Islamic State, but not before some of the other priorities are accomplished. So they just disagree on priorities, and obviously there's that personal disagreement between Ayman Zawahiri and Omar Baghdadi. There's that competition for leadership of the jihadist universe, if you want to call it that way. But ISIS sees that there's now an opportunity for them. There's an opportunity given the relative weakness of its enemies, and they don't need the Al-Qaeda brand anymore. They can create their own brand, and they have expanded so much that they feel like they don't need Al-Qaeda. And now it's actually Al-Qaeda affiliates who might be more interested in joining ISIS than the other way around. ISIS has grown to an extent where they could easily supplant Al-Qaeda, and that's, I'm sure, what U.S. and international intelligence agencies are so concerned about, is that there's a new Al-Qaeda in town, and it's called ISIS.
Well, Bilal Saab, I thank you very much for joining us.
You're most welcome. Thanks a lot for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Bilal Saab, who's an expert on Middle East security and politics with a particular focus on the Levant and the Gulf. Currently, he's a senior fellow for Middle East security at the Atlantic Council's Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the religious credentials of the new caliph and head of the Islamic State.
And until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued, but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. War is not the answer.
Mr. War is not the answer.
Politician and them bobo nyanting. War is not the answer. Thinking over the solution, Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer. Tell the politician and them start drop them bomb. Yeah. War is not the answer. Thinking over the solution, Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William McCants, who's a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy and director of the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution. He's also a faculty member at Johns Hopkins University and has served in government and think tank positions related to Islam, the Middle East, and terrorism, including as State Department senior advisor for countering violent extremism. Welcome to Background Briefing, William McCants.
Thank you for having me.
And the Vatican has urged Muslim leaders to condemn the actions of the Islamic State fighters in Iraq. What's your understanding of where the rest of Islam sees what's happening?
I think most Muslims find the Islamic State to be an aberration and abhor it. Most Muslims have very fond memories of the caliphate, the ancient caliphate, which died out in the 13th century. And look at it as a golden time in Islam, a time of learning and culture. I think they rightly view the current so-called caliphate as a pale imposter. I mean, its leaders and its members are more concerned with killing people and implementing a very brutal interpretation of Islamic law than they are with providing real governance to the citizens that they're conquering.
I spoke just the other day with Robert Baer, the former CIA officer who was in charge of the CIA's operations in the north of Iraq, in the Kurdish area between the two wars. I also spoke yesterday to the Islamic scholar, Dr. Khalid Abu al-Fadl. And Dr. al-Fadl had studied Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's sermon in Mosul. Since he's the leader of IS, then I suppose that's the source, if you will, of trying to understand what motivates this group and what their religiosity is. Dr. al-Fadl said that this is a sort of street thug who didn't seem familiar with Islamic doctrine and was kind of clumsy. I guess it'd be a bit like a mafia hitman reading Shakespeare. And then I then talked to Bob Baer about it, since he speaks Arabic, and he said, no, that he thought he handled classical Arabic quite well, and he certainly didn't come across as a street thug. So between those two opinions, where do you come down?
I guess I come down more on Bob Baer's side. I mean, I listened to the entire sermon in Arabic as well, and you know, neither Bob Baer or I are native Arabic speakers like Khalid Abu Fadl, so he can probably pick out the nuances that we can't, but he came across as quite learned. He wasn't stumbling over his words. It was a long sermon that he had apparently memorized that was replete with quotations of the Quran and early Islamic traditions attributed to Muhammad. And he had a very specific message to deliver, which I thought he delivered quite well, which is that the time has come to establish or reestablish the Islamic State, and that all of this fighting has to have a goal. We can't keep endlessly fighting and have nothing to show for it, and that is the major point that he has been pushing in the global jihadi community.
So what about reports in the New York Times that he's basically a street thug? I think those reports came from the Pentagon. He was jailed at Camp Buka for 4 years. Other reports indicate that he comes from a small village near Samarra. that his family were Sufi, which is a very tolerant form of Islam, and that the kid was always in trouble and was somewhat sadistic, tortured animals, etc. So that's the portrait, at least, that's being portrayed of him, which, again, is the street thug as opposed to the caliph.
Right. All of this is very difficult to tease out because there is propaganda going on both sides. You know, Baghdadi's supporters want to paint him as a very pious, learned man. One of his supporters said that he got a PhD in Islamic law and that he was a figure in a conservative Muslim mosque before the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. And then, as you say, you have these other reports coming out, probably sourced to the Iraqi government, that are trying to paint him as a thug and someone who is not deserving of the title of caliph. It's too early to know because both sides in this conflict are trying to define the man at the center of it.
Again, I'm speaking with William McCance, who's a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy and director of the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution. He's also an adjunct faculty member at Johns Hopkins University and has served in government and think tank positions related to Islam, the Middle East, and terrorism, including as a State Department senior advisor for countering violent extremism. So in terms of violent extremism, William McCance, nothing is more, I think, shocking than the picture on the web of a 7-year-old Australian boy holding up the severed head of a Syrian soldier, and his father, who had been arrested by the Australian authorities, had managed to get him out of the country and into Syria, and the father captioned the video saying, "That's my boy." And this, of course, has created a lot of backlash in the Australian press at the time when Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense Kerry and Hagel are visiting with their Australian counterparts, and they said that they were deeply shocked about it. So if this is a manifestation of IS, then how do you reconcile that with piety?
Well, it's very difficult for any outsider, whether they be a Muslim or a non-Muslim, to reconcile this with any sort of spirituality. I mean, it is a warrior's cult. That is what it has become. And ISIS, or now the Islamic State, presents a very bleak vision of humanity. I think it's telling that whenever they conquer a city and they set up their government buildings, they paint the buildings entirely black. And that is represents the bleakness of their vision. They're doing very little to provide actual services to people. They've made minimal efforts to alleviate the suffering of the people that they control, and they're much more concerned with implementing a very draconian interpretation of Islamic law. I mean, you have to be well beyond the pale for leaders of Al-Qaeda itself, who are no wimps and are quite bloodthirsty in their own right, to say, "Wow, this group has gone too far," and it has. And I think it has not just divided the jihadi community, but it has also brought upon itself the ire and condemnation of the Muslim world.
And what do you think its aims and future are? I mean, first of all, I find it hard to believe that this is a sort of spontaneous group that sort of suddenly exploded out of the Syrian civil war. And, you know, I can't believe that 10,000 fighters have taken over so much territory, led by somebody that spent years in prison and doesn't necessarily have any military experience. Is there another hand? Are there state actors behind this?
It is very difficult to say from the outside. To be sure, ISIS is working with groups in Iraq, particularly the former members of Saddam's military that have a lot of military training. Remember, ISIS itself, a lot of its senior leaders, they've had a decade now of fighting experience and carrying out a long terror campaign and now an insurgent campaign. And their ranks are swelling from people that are coming from other conflicts that are winding down, say in Afghanistan, to join the fight to reestablish the caliphate. So they have a lot of human resources that they can draw on. And Baghdadi himself seems to be a very good manager. Now, whether he's a brilliant military tactician or not is unclear, because it's not apparent to outsiders who is calling the shots in terms of the military operations. But to be sure, he is giving his lieutenants enough leeway to make quick decisions on the ground. And I think that's one of the notable things about ISIS is that it is very flexible and very mobile. They can take over a city quickly, leave it the next day, and pop up 200 miles elsewhere if need be. It is a very, very flexible insurgent organization, which makes it difficult to contain it.
But if, as you say, they paint the buildings black, they don't have any interest in governance, and they don't seem to have a plan beyond this sort of chimeric idea of creating a caliphate. To my mind, the main signal that they send, and this is why I wonder whether people like the Saudis are behind them or at least helping them, is that their message is the antithesis of the Arab Spring. There's no hope, there's no freedom, there's no democracy in this. This is the reverse, an incredibly black vision of a future.
It's true, but I would be very surprised if the Saudis had anything to do with it. The Saudis are terrified of this organization. They're very worried that it is now on its borders. If ISIS decided to send a convoy into Saudi Arabia, it would be incredibly damaging to the regime. And the Saudis, even in Syria, have shied away from funding more moderate Islamists like the Muslim Brotherhood, and even stay away from conservative Islamists. They've opted more for nationally oriented rebels against the Assad regime because they're worried about this kind of blowback.
So then the fact that they've cut across this so-called Shia Crescent, which links Iran through Iraq to the Assad regime in Syria and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Is there anything to be taken from that? The fact that, at least if they're not surrogates of the Saudis and others who oppose Iran and Iran's influence, they're certainly helping.
That is true. And there has been some whispers that the Iranians themselves were supporting them in Syria. Again, it's hard to tell from the outside, but certainly in eastern Syria, there was an alignment of interests between the Assad regime and ISIS. I mean, the Assad regime has an interest in seeing the Sunni rebels divided and fighting among themselves, and ISIS has an interest in not moving quickly to topple the Assad regime, but rather consolidating their control in eastern Syria and western Iraq.
And, of course, ISIS is now moving against Lebanon. They've had some clashes with the Lebanese army, and apparently they've got their eye on Tripoli. So there is, I guess the broader question here is, in terms of, you mentioned the Al-Qaeda, they were so radical that Al-Qaeda had to cut them loose or distance themselves from them. At this point, they seem to be about getting rid of the Sykes-Picot borders and creating this new caliphate, as opposed to striking the far enemy, as the Al-Qaeda called the United States, with 9/11. Are we just lucky that they haven't got to that stage, or do you think that's something that's going to happen in the future?
It will happen in the future. I mean, these fellows are global jihadis of the Al-Qaeda stripe. They believe that the United States should be taken on and pushed out of the Middle East. I think at this moment, Baghdadi's calculation and focus is on controlling territory. But given that the United States has initiated strikes against the organization, I wouldn't be surprised if Baghdadi ordered strikes against U.S. interests, probably in the region. More distant possibility would be an attack on the homeland, but it would be really difficult for them to pull it off.
And what about Israel? They don't seem to have much of a focus on Israel, or perhaps I've missed something.
No, not yet. I mean, they have gone for the low-hanging fruit, which are these vast, undergoverned areas in eastern Syria and western Iraq. And that is going to remain their home base for a long time. I think there are a lot of other governments that they deem to be much weaker than Israel that they would focus on before going after Israel itself.
So in terms of where we started out talking about the Vatican urging Muslim leaders to condemn the actions of IS and ISIS, I always thought that throughout the George W. Bush's war on terror, that it seemed sort of counterintuitive to describe, first of all, bin Laden and al-Qaeda as jihadis, because that's actually could be construed as a noble term, a spiritual term.
why we didn't call them criminals instead of jihadists in the first place. And it seemed to me that at the end of the day, no Christian or Jew can convince a young Muslim who's about to take a radical path. The only person who could dissuade a person about to take a radical path would be what we loosely call a moderate Islamist. So I've always been surprised that that's not where we put our focus, is on aiding and abetting, nurturing and supporting moderate Islam, as opposed to demonizing the whole religion.
Well, I can say, having worked in the U.S. government has put a lot of its focus on encouraging moderate Muslims to speak out against al-Qaeda. You know, but of course, the United States is also limited because in the conduct of our foreign affairs, we try not to encourage one brand of religion over another. So we walk a fine line, and the U.S. government tends to focus on prompting Muslims to speak out against human rights abuses, criminal activity, things that people of any religious persuasion or no persuasion would find objectionable. And there have been a lot of moderate Muslims that have spoken out against al-Qaeda over the years. And there's also a lot of Muslims, most people don't know, a lot of Muslims working in the U.S. government, particularly in the national security sector, trying to keep Americans safe from these groups.
But at the end of the day, a regime like Saudi Arabia, who have really, you know, they helped create the Taliban, the Wahhabis, money, obviously for unlimited oil funds, has spread around the world. They, to some extent, destabilized Pakistan. They've propagated a fairly austere, reactionary, and xenophobic form of Islam. You were saying earlier that they're afraid of the Islamic State, but are they having buyer's remorse about the extent to which they have shaped Islam around the world?
No, and they should, but they don't. And they don't really see this as a contradictory policy. They don't see much connection between the religious vision that they propagate, which is extremely conservative and can be very hostile to outsiders, and the kind of militancy that arises from that tradition. They are focused on combating the more militant phenomena that arises from it rather than looking at the tradition that can inspire it.
Well, William McCance, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with William McCance, who's a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy and a director of the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution. He's also an adjunct faculty member at Johns Hopkins University and has served in government and think tank positions related to Islam, the Middle East, and terrorism, including as State Department Senior Advisor for Countering Violent Extremism. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the historical amnesia and political spin underway over Iraq.
Does it easy, does it? They got something to say.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Van Buren, who is a 24-year veteran foreign service officer at the State Department who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with his full benefits. And he is the author of the new book, Ghosts of Tom Joad, A Story of the 99%. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Van Buren.
It's a pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And when you were working in Iraq, losing the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people,
Could you have imagined anything as bad as what's happening now, where you've got thousands of civilians trapped on a mountaintop, which was apparently the resting place of Noah's Ark? Hundreds of dead bodies are strewn about, helicopters are landing, you can only pick up 20 people, and there are thousands of people trying to get away from the clutches of this murderous Islamic State marauders. And you've got back in the capital this completely dysfunctional government where there's the president has appointed a new prime minister, but the outgoing prime minister refuses to budge, and he may even employ his security forces. And we may even have a little bit of some gun battles here to decide who the next prime minister of Iraq is. So what did you ever think it could be as bad as this?
Well, I think, like you, I'm shocked at the level of violence and the horrors that are taking place in Iraq. I'm sadly not surprised that what is happening in some form. In fact, the publisher and I have joked that my book, we titled We Meant Well, should probably be retitled as I Told You So, because so much of what is happening in Iraq now was inevitable given the way that the United States conducted its occupation there.
Well, but of course, that's becoming a political football in this election year, Peter Van Buren, where the Republicans, who apparently have no regard for the facts or for history, are saying that Obama somehow abandoned the place when it was Bush who made the deal to get out. And Obama did, in fact, try to extend U.S. troop presences, but the sovereign government, perhaps under pressure or likely under pressure from Iran, forced the U.S. out. And one of the sticking points, of course, was immunity for American soldiers. And thanks to the activities of Blackwater, the Iraqis were having none of that. So how do you deal with the reality when you've got this total political spin going on?
It's very difficult because the Republicans are not only ignoring the recent history that you've mentioned quite correctly there, but also the history that took place between 2003 and 2011 when the United States ended its first round of participation in this war. 2003, Iraq was a stable country. The tensions between the Sunni Shias and Kurds were kept in check by Saddam, albeit through bloody means and horrible violations of human rights. When the United States unleashed those tensions by the regime change, destroying Saddam, we didn't replace that civil government with anything. That vacuum was quickly taken over by these tensions and the Sunni Shia conflict. The Kurds kind of sat most of this out, creating their own de facto nation state. And nothing was done to replace that vacuum. The United States put in a fake governing council, of which the current prime minister nominee in Iraq was a member. And then in 2006, an election that was boycotted by the Sunnis, the United States put Maliki in power. We allowed the Iranians to support his second time into the prime ministership in 2010. And throughout that period of time, America never, ever insisted that the Iraqi government reconcile, create a unity government, create any kind of a structure that was inclusive for the Sunnis, if not possibly also the Kurds. And so to suddenly fast forward to 2014 and say that this is Obama's fault in any way whatsoever, or that keeping some form of military presence in Iraq for the last 2 or 3 years would have changed anything, really defies logic, never mind ignoring history.
So, Peter Van Buren, what was going on, though, when George W. Bush apparently almost every day was teleconferencing with Maliki and coaching him? Obviously, it didn't work, but what was the idea there, that somehow this president here in the United States who'd got us into this mess was going to somehow help this leader who seems to have he seems to be dominated by sectarian instincts? Do you know what was going on in those daily teleconferences?
I was never lucky enough to sit in on any of those, but based on what I've heard from people who did participate, and particularly based on what we've seen as the outcome of that, this seems to be another sad example of America's foreign policy delusion that we can install leaders in countries around the world and then manipulate them as puppets to what we believe are the proper ends. We ignore that many of these people have no legitimacy in their own country. We ignore that many of them are simultaneously saying the things America wants them to say while doing things that are completely anthemic to America's interests. And we seem to believe that this strategy will work the next time when it hasn't worked any of the previous times. You can go through a long, long history of this. If you want to stay in Iraq, you can particularly talk about the CIA's efforts that put Saddam in power in the first place. Vietnam is another example. Central America, the wars of the 1980s are good examples. But the idea that the U.S. could stick Maliki into power and maintain him there as a puppet and at the same time control him, well, there's not a lot of history that supports that either. And I think by the time that the Bush-Maliki relationship was ending, really, George Bush and maybe David Petraeus were the only people left in the world who believed that a single, unified, centralized Iraq still existed or would be possible to create.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department, who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with his full benefits. He is the author of the new book, Ghosts of Tom Joad, A Story of the 99%. And Peter, I spoke the other day with Bob Baer, the former CIA officer who ran the Kurdish North, or the CIA's operations in the Kurdish North between the two Iraq wars. And he was just more or less echoed what you've been saying about this delusion of creating a unity government in a country that's already broken apart. And he said that, you know, this is the problem is that these State Department lawyers are still sticking to that delusion. Is that where the problem is? I mean, what? And it's not as if the other people in the neighborhood, the French, were just there saying the same stuff. Even the Iranians, as far as I know, still want a unity government. Why this collective delusion?
I don't know if I would blame it entirely on State Department lawyers, though I clearly have no love for the Department of State. I think this represents a very desperate U.S. government-wide sense that if we admit the obvious, that Iraq is destined to become three or more nation statelets, if we admit the obvious, then we are admitting defeat, not only for the Obama administration, but in fact for the course of the United States since 9/11. And I just simply believe that America's hubris and America's politics and America's arrogance, that exceptionalism thing again, makes it impossible to admit the obvious and move forward. Again, going back into history, we saw this in Vietnam, where despite the fact that that war was lost over and over again over a period of years, the United States refused to simply accept that. You look back at Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, who publicly was feeding more and more American soldiers into the Vietnam War while privately making clear in his diary and his comments that he knew the war was lost. The war in Iraq is over, and America did lose. And America did create a situation that will resolve itself in the dissolution of this singular state. America's only hope right now to salvage anything alongside of our own interests is to help manage that dissolution in the least violent and anarchic way possible, in hopes that at the end of it all, those nation statelets will have some positive connections to the United States and contribute in some way to stability in the Middle East. Right now, we're simply fanning the flames and watching them spread out of Iraq, further into the Middle East, Syria, Turkey, Iran, potentially into Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, who are some of the primary funders for ISIS. This is not a time for quick fixes. It's a time for us to acknowledge the reality and begin to act on that reality.
But Peter Van Buren, are we capable of acknowledging the reality that our Saudi allies, the Al Saud family, have perpetually, for decades, stabbed us in the back? You can't say that they created Al Qaeda, but Al Qaeda was created in their country.
They certainly helped create and fund the Taliban. They have helped destabilize Pakistan. Their money is spreading through mosques around the world, spreading this extremely xenophobic, austere version of Islam, the Wahhabi sect. And you just mentioned that they're funding ISIS. Clearly, this organization is not being run by this one guy. I can't believe this former street thug turned caliph is capable of running this whole organization. And it seems to me to be a part of the broader competition, if you will, or you know, surrogate war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. I mean, it seems to me that the Saudis are really dedicated to destroying any hope of the Arab Spring. They don't want any democracy. They don't want anything like that. And they'd be happy to spread jihad around the world as long as the Al Saud family maintains its position of power and privilege.
U.S.-Saudi relations are in the background of almost every significant event in our lifetimes in the Middle East. So I was talking to one of Bob Baer's perhaps colleagues, if you will, who said, you know, after 9/11, we invaded two of the wrong countries. Instead of Iraq and Afghanistan, we should have invaded Saudi and Pakistan if we really had wanted to do something about the problems that America was facing after the 9/11 attacks. The Saudis have been extremely skillful. They've played the oil card very well against the United States. And more recently, they have manipulated the United States quite successfully. We all know that the Saudis were America's proxy in getting the Soviet-Afghan war funded and implemented. And we do know that the Saudis have been on America's, quote, side in funding ISIS when ISIS, with some form of ISIS, if you will, was fighting against Assad in Syria. The United States simply must come to grips with these realities, that we can't claim the Saudis are our friends when they fund ISIS on one side of the border, but it's not okay if they fund ISIS on the other side of a border. The same thing with the Iranians. We simply can't say that the Iranians are a threat to everything that's important to America in the Persian Gulf region, but now that they're on our side in Iraq, supposedly, or in appearances, well, that's okay. These kind of short-term thinking that seems to permeate American foreign policy, to my ultimate mystification, I guess you could blame it on politics, this kind of short-term thinking continues to boomerang back at the United States, and I simply don't understand at some point why adult supervision doesn't step in. If I may, a quick comment about the Kurds and the weapons along these same lines of short-term thinking. It appears now that ISIS is using American weapons given to the Iraqis to fight against Kurds. The United States is now supplying weapons to the Kurds to fight against the American weapons that ISIS got from the Iraqi-supplied Americans. So you'd kind of think at some point someone would say, perhaps introducing American weapons into these conflicts is inherently destabilizing and dangerous. You cannot control where they end up. But yet, we seem to be pursuing that policy over and over again. I think the only people who are happy are the arms merchants who are watching American weapons blow up other American weapons and figuring the sales that are going to come out of this.
But just to address the political side as opposed to the military side, and it's pretty clear that the IS, the Islamic State, or ISIS, are likely to create a war situation in that part of the world for some time to come. At the very least, they've cut across the so-called Shia Crescent, and they're not capable of governance, but they're certainly capable of destabilizing the neighborhood. But on the political side, it seems to me that the Saudis' fingerprints are all over this sort of destruction of the hope of the Arab Spring. They colluded with the generals and financed the generals in Egypt to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood. They don't want any form of democracy because they have an absolute monarchy controlled by religious police. And it seems to me that, again, even though they said they had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, they seem to be funding jihad around the world as an alternative to the Arab Spring. And I don't think you could have a more stark alternative, could you not? Perhaps I'm being too Western and idealistic. But the idea, the choice between self-governance and democracy, as opposed to cutting people's heads off and having seven-year-old boys hold up the head of a Syrian soldier. I mean, what is going on here?
You know, Ian, if I had a good answer, I'd probably be running for office someplace. The United States has in its power the ability to at least limit Saudi interference in other parts of the Middle East, but it doesn't want to. It wants Saudi funding for, we'll just call them rebels in Syria, because the United States wants to get rid of Assad. It wants the Saudis as a buttress against Iranian power in the Persian Gulf. What the United States doesn't seem to understand is the very high price that ends up costing us, that you cannot accept Saudi influence in one place and hope that the Saudis will not spread their influence in other places. The same for the Iranians, the same for any country you want to pick in the Middle East that has the ability to act outside of its own borders. Without any coherent foreign policy, and it's very difficult to find one in the Middle East, going back as many handfuls of years, certainly to 9/11, without any coherent foreign policy to guide us, we continue to create these short-term quick fixes, these hopeful little gestures, this fantasy that it still is a chessboard where we can make moves in Saudi that only affect the game in Saudi, and moves in Iraq that only affect the game in Iraq. If it was ever true, it certainly is not true in our globalized, multipolar world. The longer we play the game that way, the more we will continue to lose the game that way. Iraq is the most obvious example. It's staring us in the face. And unfortunately, we're stepping back into the quagmire. We've got 300 soldiers on the ground. The Pentagon has telegraphed today that they anticipate the need for more soldiers on the ground. We're conducting airstrikes. And these are just the overt things that are going on. It's very possible that the U.S. has a lot of more covert operations, including perhaps special forces on the ground. It's time to withdraw from fights that not only we can't win, but that we're making worse simply by being there.
Well, Peter Van Buren, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department, who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with his full benefits. His latest book is Ghosts of Tom Joad, A Story of the 99%. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.